It's Thursday, June 2nd, 2011, and you're listening to episode 233 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
First auction is over and we have a winner. We will be working out a time with a gentleman named Michael to get him on the mics for a guest episode. He's already picked his topic and everything. So
his topic?
His topic is, well, I don't know. I don't know if I should announce it. We'll get there when we get there.
I want to be surprised.
I don't even know his topic.
But
I don't even know who it is, actually. Michael is the first I've heard of it.
What I would like to do is tease the next auction. It's not going to start with this show.
How are you going to tease it?
It's
You're going to tickle it a little bit? You're going to give it a little pinch?
I'm going to make fun of it.
Oh, you're one of those kinds.
Look at you, little auction. Look at
well,
you,
some
you
people are into
little
that.
Auctions.
I'm going to call it dirty. And that's what this auction likes. No, this
is sick bastard. You were helping children here.
We're helping adults as well, apparently.
Yeah.
This auction is... This auction is going to start not with this episode, but with next episode. So you have 1 week to kind of get yourself set for it. All right. So here's what we got. I've been in contact with Mr. Fred Hicks from Evil Hat and
Righteous Hat.
Yeah. After talking to this guy and working out with him, what, you know, he's willing to help us out with this auction, I just couldn't accept anymore that we were getting this from an Evil Hat. So in honor of their hard work, I have gone out and reserved the domain name Righteous Hat and redirected it to their site. So if you want to visit them properly, do not go to evilhat.com. Go to righteoushat.com.
I still think we should have gone with Lawful Good Hat.
It's too long.
I like From a Certain Point of View Hat.
I just wonder, because their
misunderstood hat.
Their logo is an evil hat, a hat with teeth, and he's all growly and stuff. I wonder what Righteous Hat looks like. We need a graphic of Righteous Hat.
We do, and if we...
My guess it would have an afro.
If we do, I may actually have to put up a Righteous Hat site where you see the Righteous Hat, and maybe it, like, morphs into an evil hat and then redirects to their site. It, like, falls or something.
Yeah, like you click it. And
I don't know how this is going to work, but for the moment, Righteous Hat is the proper portal to their site. All right, but here's what Fred has offered up. He is going to give one copy, and we're talking physical copy here, and that will become more obvious once I fully explain this, but he is offering one copy of the Dresden Files book, Our World, which is the GM's book. He is offering to go with it several copies of Your Story, which is the player book. So you have enough to outfit your entire gaming group. So it's going to be like one GM book, and it's going to be like three or four or however many players' handbooks that he's willing to donate.
That alone, we're talking about over $100.
So then, on top of that, what's going to happen is Fred Hicks and Rob Donahue are both going to sign the book, and if you want, we'll personalize the message to you, thanking you for what you're doing. So they will sign it for you as a collector's item. They are going to ship it to us. Fear the Boot will then sign this copy and then pass it along to you.
And the value has now dropped below $100.
That's how we make it cheap. Now, this is why shipping is free. Now, in case you do not own any fudge dice, Fred is going to dip into his own personal bowl of dice.
My understanding that was more of his personal dice vault.
And
he said he has tons of these.
So he is going to send with it some of his own fudge dice, and he said enough to go with each book so everyone at the table can play the game. So basically, we are going to take you from zero to collector's edition style Dresden Files for your whole gaming table.
Fully ready to rock.
This auction will run for 10 days and will start next week Wednesday when that episode drops. So if you're interested in this, now is your chance to be thinking about who you are going to kill to get that money.
Just think how worthless that book will be if somebody gets it and then finds... Who's the author of the Dresden Files? I apologize.
Jim Butcher.
Goes to a signing of with Jim Butcher and says, hey, could you sign this? And he's like, where?
There's always space. And actually, well, I want to put this with strong caveats. In fact, I wasn't even going to bring this up until you said that.
Uh-oh, caveat.
There is a tiny chance, and let me stress tiny chance, that Jim Butcher may also be autographing the books. But
don't bid on that.
Don't bid on it for that reason, because there are several hurdles involved with that. And so we can't guarantee that's going to happen. We can guarantee the book will be signed by Fred, By Rob Donahue and by the host of Fear the Boot.
Yeah. It is a very, very busy time for Jim Butcher.
Yeah,
right
he's
now.
A busy man. And
he has a book he's still finishing up.
This exactly. So we are trying for that. But once again, please do not bid on it expecting that to be part of the prize. I can guarantee the rest of it. I can't guarantee that part. So that's what we got coming up. Wayne, you wanted to talk about something.
Yep. So last year, right around this time, I had a bitch.
What was her name?
You misogynist.
No answer I can say to that would be good. So we'll
try.
I had a complaint, and it was that Free RPG Day came, and none of us had heard anything about
it. Clean up after itself.
Well, that too. I walked into the store, and that was the first we knew that Free RPG Day was that day. So, you know, I complained about it on here.
No, you didn't. You sent me a text, then I went. Yes. And I got free RPGs, which I then put on the prize table at Fear the Con, and they were giving half off. I don't know if I've told this story before.
Yes, you have.
Oh, excellent. I'll tell it again, you son of a bitch. They were running half off all of their RPGs, all their other RPGs.
And
they
had Savage Worlds for $4.99.
And they had the Doctor Who box set.
Yeah, I tucked behind other books like they weren't meant to be selling. You got it half price, and the guy seemed really upset about
it. The point is,
this year, they reached out to us. The organizers of Free RPG Day a couple months ago shot me an email. We talked a little bit back and forth. So I wanted to make sure everyone knows this year, Free RPG Day is June 18th.
One of the complaints that we as a podcast have had, which Chad has elocuted many times, and he is correct in doing so, is that this holiday...
It's preaching to the choir.
It's a bit inbred.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, like Chad said, you're preaching to the converted. That basically, you're offering free RPGs to the people that walk into RPG shops who are the people that already play RPGs anyway. Now, rather than just bitch about that, Chris...
Yes.
Doing something that apparently was popular back in the olden days, came up with a positive suggestion of how to address that. Now, Chris, in order to give credit where credit is due, I was wondering if you would share what your suggestion was.
I would be more than happy to do so. And you're absolutely right. This is many years ago. I think this was at least 25, if not 30 years ago. Back in my old church, our pastor at the time, he was a great guy, a little bit on the hippie side, but really a nice all-around, a good spiritual leader. He decided to do basically take a friend to church day, and he invited everybody in the congregation to bring someone to church with them that either didn't go to the church or didn't go to church at all, or either one of those two categories. And it was actually fairly successful. I have no idea how many actually stayed after that fact, but the important thing here is the effort was made. And my suggestion was something similar like this should be done for Free RPG Day. If there's games to be played, and a lot of gaming stores will, you know, either run demos on Free RPG Day, or they certainly have that stuff available. Get that material. Some of the stuff has been pretty scaled back rules-wise, so make it more approachable for newcomers. Well, then do that. Go and find some people that you know that have never played RPGs before, or who have not played this particular RPG, which may be free on this day, and invite them to play. Introduce them to a new game, or introduce them to the hobby as a whole, and go out there and grab more people, and really try to make this holiday. I think what the intention was is to bring in people who haven't played, who may have been interested, who maybe have always been curious, and give them a shot at it. Let them see what it's like. I mean, the price is right.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a great opportunity to do so because of the fact that people are naturally drawn to free stuff. I don't know if anyone here has heard of the free cheese riot. It really did occur. People love free stuff. And I was going to expand on Chris's idea a little bit. If you've got friends who maybe you can't get to go with you to the RPG shop to look at the products, to pick up the books, to talk to the people, but they might be open-minded enough at least to try it. When you go to Free RPG Day, whatever RPG you pick up there for cheap or free, turn around and give to someone who would not otherwise take a look at the hobby. Certainly, get them in there. That's a great idea. But even if that's not possible, there are still ways where right now you can set for yourself a goal. If you're the sort of person who wants to proselytize the hobby, then pick somebody out right now. Think of that person who's a nerd with a D20 shaped hole in their life. And this holiday, I want you on June 18th to get them involved in Free RPG Day, because that is the type of person, what we will call a Wayne, like where Wayne was before Chad found him. This is the person This is the soul that needs you.
It's not just you as an individual, but maybe you and a couple core people from your group, and make it a group experience and show them what the fun really is all about and the good times that you can have with this. And if you're all going in there with that same goal, like, hey, we're bringing in some new people, we want them to have a good time, all the other regular players out there can be focused on that effort to make sure that, you know, yeah, it's an enjoyable experience and that they'll get new players into the hobby.
Would you condone tricking someone?
Oh, sure. For example, what I might say is something like, hey, my church group is going over to an RPG shop. You want to come and see what happens? And see, they'll go thinking there's going to be all kinds of, you know, hilarity that's going to ensue. And in truth, they're going to get there and a game's going to break out because, you know, the people I associate with really don't object to this kind of thing.
I was more thinking...
Come on, you got it. That's a great idea.
I was more thinking of something a little bit more benign of saying, hey, you want to go out for beers or something? Sure. Oh, wait.
And then roofie them?
No.
I was just thinking most game stores are comic book stores, too. Hey, you want to go to the comic book shop?
They wake up naked with a D20 on their belly.
Yeah, go to the comic book shop or like, hey, let's just stop off here for a second. Oh, hey, look, you get a free book and put it in their hands. And
send them out the door with it. You know? Okay.
And then you talk about it and then, you know...
That's a slightly less nefarious lie that I came up with. But
leads to another. Suddenly you're playing RPGs all night long.
All night long.
Hey, whatever it takes. Right.
So whatever stupidity you come up with, it can't be any worse than what we just did. So June 18th. All right, let's get down to I was going to say more RPG-related topic. That was perfectly RPG-related. So let's get down to a different RPG-related topic. I have one more thought on narrative combat, because this is obviously the subject we kicked around last show.
I don't think anybody's going to be interested in that, though. I mean, it's not like anybody talked about the last time we did it, so.
Yeah, it's just like 14 pages of discussion.
Yeah, like exploded overnight. It was crazy.
There was something that occurred in our game this past Sunday. And actually, Chad, as I was digesting this mentally in the hours thereafter, you know what it reminded me of? In Final Fantasy 3/6, depending on how you want to number it, and again in Final Fantasy 9, and I've seen this in a few other JRPGs, there will be a moment in the game where the characters have to act out a play or an opera or whatever, depending on the game.
Yeah.
And they actually go through combats and situations, and you have dialogue you have to get down and lines you have to pick from, or improv scenes or whatever. And based on what you do, there's in Final Fantasy VII as well, they had something like this. So it was a little hard to get to, but they had something like that in the Golden Saucer. But the characters have to go through a play where they act out characters. They may even go into the typical combat system, but all of it's within the context of this isn't a real part of the game. So this past Sunday, as we've mentioned on the show, the current campaign we're playing was about a group of guys who started off as traveling performers who went from town to town putting on medieval style plays and performances and to a certain extent kind of freak shows and such, and then would go on to the next town and do it again. Well, we hit a point where we achieved some gold, settled down for a little bit, and moved on to bigger and better things. But now we're back on the road again. We ended up in a little way town and decided, you know, we have a day or two to kill while we wait on somebody else to arrive. Let's improv a show. And so on the spot, we decided to make up a play. And so I just made up a name. I said, okay, well, there's this play called The Champion of Carville, but there's a lot of women in this town, so we're going to rename it to The Lady of Carville, and it's about how this woman suddenly finds out she's this unexpected warrior of great skill and strikes down a giant gnoll played by my character, much to the cheers of the audience. And what kind of surprised me is because in the past, you've had us role play out some of this stuff and kind of make up the lines and explain how we're going through all of it. You cleared the table, you put down some makeshift terrain, you put down our figs, and basically said, okay, here is a die on 6. This play, you're in the final act of it, and you have 6 rounds for the play to end.
Yep. It has to have that climactic ending. You just can't, like, wait the die out.
And we used standard D&D 3/5 combat rules for a play. where the attack rolls were not actual attacks.
Like, if you successfully made the attack roll, you quote-unquote hit.
And it was an impressive hit to the audience.
And it was impressive hit. No damage is
but
done.
But no damage actually occurred.
What happens if you critically miss, though? Yeah. Even though there's no critical misses. And if you roll a 1, I think I said if you roll 5 and under, you actually hit the person.
Yeah, and it did happen once.
Yeah. And you rolled a 1, and it was like, okay, you rolled that full damage out. And it was really cool. They had to actually roll with that and kind of incorporate it in. They didn't incorporate it into the play. They did everything they could to cover it.
Right.
But yeah, see, it was great.
That is what was really cool to me about the whole thing, was the fact that it forced us to do a highly narrative combat. Because of the fact that we had a story within a story, there's mm-hmm. the story of the play. Our characters are playing other characters. This is very M.C. Escher, I guess. If characters are playing other characters, we were going through a combat, yet out of this, we had to create and maintain a high dialogue, mm-hmm. cogent story fight
yep,
that had ebb and flow mm-hmm. and rises and falls and unexpected twists and turns. And when Chad gave us audience reaction mm-hmm. or when one of my other characters
yep.
started interfering from the stands, we had to roll with this without actually breaking the combat. But through all of this, mm-hmm. we had this story going, and the fact that it had to be a play forced us mm-hmm. to keep that story front and center.
Yeah.
There was no out-of-character metagaming, well, let me measure this and total up this and average out this and check that chart and I'm just going to swing and roll. I mean, there had to be description to every move. There had to be flair and purpose to everything we did.
Mm-hmm. The cool thing about it, because it's not like when we do combat normally, where the hits count and we're not trying to entertain a town, we do role play that out. You know, it's like my character says, blah, 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 you know, have at thee. And, you know, I strike him instead of just I do D12 damage. I slash him and hack off his arm or whatever. You know, we're very descriptive in that. It was really cool in that the players were trying to tell a story that was on top of the combat, that was separate of the story that we're telling in the game. And they used combat, the mechanical dice combat, to express that story.
The story didn't stop when the combat began.
Right.
In fact, in this case, by quite an oddity, the story actually started when the combat
yes.
began. But what I got from that I think is a great challenge to us as a group, mm-hmm. and I think is a great challenge to anyone else that is interested in this style of play, is to take out a level. Mm-hmm. Now, what I mean by that is we were players playing characters who were playing characters. Take it back a step. You are a person trying to put on an entertaining story. The audience is the other people around the table.
Mm-hmm.
How can you put on a play that entertains them even if your characters are in a real combat where they're trying to kill real people or real monsters? But at the same time, that narrative never stops.
Right.
And how successful was the play?
Extremely. It almost fell apart.
Yep, they saved it at the end.
We saved it at the end. To give the story in short, the two characters I'm playing, I have the Gnoll champion who's basically trying to work with the party, and then I have a Gnoll shaman who's kind of a dick.
I love him.
Midway through the play, he decided that he was going to try and help because the audience is supposed to be afraid of the Gnoll.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually put down like an area effect, horror effect. I mean, not one that was like a send people screaming and running, but just to enhance it. Yes, it was going to create an ambient emotion of horror. So it was supposed to be a romping, semi-comedy adventure, swashbuckling sort of story,
mm-hmm.
suddenly turned into a horror movie. And Basically, Chad said, look, if you guys can't stop him from sustaining this spell, you are going to leave the audience not entertained, but mortified.
Yeah, and we're all left in the middle of trying to put on this play, trying to figure out, how do we stop this guy off on the side?
Because we can't break character
without leaving the stage.
Yeah, we can't break character and run over there and hit him, because if we do, we've ruined our own play. And so at the time, Pat's character was playing a peasant who was on my character's back trying to, you know, wrestle him down with punches. Mm-hmm. He was sort of a comedy relief character. And I said to him in Gnollish, because nobody in the audience spoke Gnollish, and it sounded like I was screaming lines, do you care if I do something really disrespectful? And he said no. So fastball special. I took Pat, threw him, makeshift weapon. Even on a makeshift weapon, I rolled a natural 19 before even adding any combat modifiers to it.
And then Pat took it one step higher with the stone skin
and knocked the guy over and ended the spell.
And that was another cool thing about it. You had some very magical characters, but nobody in the town was supposed to know that you guys were of a certain ability and skill set. So they couldn't really cast flashy spells. They couldn't use spells to glamour up the production. I mean, when they got quote-unquote cut, it was the old stage trick of they had red ribbon and red confetti come out of them and that sort of thing. Everything was supposed to be fake. And so they had a handful of spells during the course of the thing, but it was very undercover. It was more or less to cover things up because only one person got really hit and Dan rolled like a one on his miss, which means that
it was a critical hit.
Yeah, which is a quote-unquote critical hit.
It was a critical failure of the fake fighting, which means it was a critical success of real fighting.
Yeah, you actually hit him as bad as you could have.
Yeah, and I had Dan roll that out, and, you know, I described it. It's like, okay, you break her nose, and you cut her head, and you bash her shield, and she's on the ground. Nobody sees the injury because she's covered up with the shield. But as soon as she stands up, I mean, there's real blood and a broken friggin' nose. And what do you guys do? And so she had to, like, hide under a shield. And she, thankfully for her, she was a druid and she was able to use a healing spell.
I always worked it into the play. Real quick, I had my character improv. What's this mist I see? Surely the spirits cannot be with a woman so weak. And so we just kind of worked it in like it was an intended special effect. And then she pops back up and quote unquote finishes me off.
And the cool thing about it, they were able to turn that around. It was a failure that they were able to make into a success because it was she was defeated, but she came back from the ashes, so to speak, to defeat the gnoll.
And that's the layer of narrative that ought to be there in every combat. Exactly. I mean, maybe not to that sort of a campy extreme.
Right.
But nonetheless,
it was a campy play.
I have never liked the idea that when the minis go down, the game you were playing 10 seconds before stops.
Yeah.
And a completely different game takes hold. And this was a wonderful thought exercise. This was like a Schrodinger's play.
Well, I think one of the things that really helped with this, too, was Dan, your character was trying to lose. Because
we didn't have our story. We just knew, you know, somehow Gnarl has to die at the end of it.
Yeah, but humans won't cheer if the monster wins.
But when you face the evil wizard, your guys have to win. And I don't mean that in a, oh, you shouldn't kill characters sort of thing, but I mean that in a, everybody is going into this and rolling dice to try and win. Who here would roll dice and get a success, but then look at the game master and go, can I choose what I do? And can I fail that? Because that would be more interesting. That's hard for a lot of people to say that.
But, you know, and one side effect here that, as I sit here and listen, because, I mean, all four of you are, you're all in the game, and here in my forever aloneness, I just listen to the stories. But
have all that corn, Chris.
And Bubba, who may or may not have a telephone.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing, though, in your voices as you're retelling this,
I ride my lawnmower at night.
It's the musical episode.
I'm sorry, Chris.
No, that's okay. No, Bubba's not out tonight. Oh, it's not dark enough yet. Yeah.
The grass will see it coming.
Which is the worst. You don't want to ever. You want to surprise the grass out here. Otherwise, it strikes back. But what I'm hearing in your voice, it's clear to hear the level of the enjoyment that you guys had in the retelling of the story and essentially the reliving of the story. And what this is doing is, even though it's the example that it is, there's still combat involved, but yet that is the exciting part of the story, is how you guys were, you know, narrating this and essentially trying to fake it, but yet make it at the same time. But this could have been just simply resolved down to a bunch of dice rolls and not created the memory that you guys are going to stick, that's going to stick with you guys for years. And I think that's where a lot of the extra intangible benefit comes out of this, is what this is doing now for this experience. You've created this incredible experience that's has grown more than just would have been maybe a half a dozen dice rolls amongst a lot of you if you would have tried to just do this scene via the dice and the dice only. And I think that that's where a really nice benefit comes out of this. And it's, like I said, it's clear in your voice. I can hear how much you guys enjoyed this.
I wonder how many people are listening to this and going, what the hell are these guys talking about? We role play out every dice combat. you know, I always say, haha, have at you and do, like, you know, cut off his arm, yay, verily. And we put a lot of RP into it.
I don't.
If they do, great.
Great.
They're ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, we do it
in
too.
In that regard, yeah. I guess.
We usually do a lot of that.
I mean, yeah.
It's never just I do 12 points of damage.
Yeah.
Because I don't actually hit anything.
I think for us and a lot of other people, it's a matter of path of least resistance. It's not a matter of we don't know how, we don't want to, or whatever. It's a matter of we go into it, lots of role-playing and stuff, but in a particularly crunchy system, you start really getting into the rules, the math, the dice. Even outside of that, you get into the tactics, the strategy, what's the plan, how are we doing this? And your mental processes are kind of putting all of the resources to that and not as many to the role-play.
Right.
That's why I like rules light. Not to say that you can't have, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica of rule systems and not have role play. But I do think that, you know, for most people, the more crunch you get into it, it doesn't stop the role play. It never stops the role play, but it distracts from it. It makes that path of least resistance of saying, well, I'm just going to roll some dice. You know, it's like, okay, we roll initiative, we roll the hit, we roll the damage. Next turn, roll the hit, roll damage. Okay, back to role play. And I see it as a sort of a path of least resistance.
You know, Chet, you mentioned you wonder if any of us around the table would roll a success and willingly say, I'd like to narrate that and I'd like to fail. You know, I thought about that a lot. There are some systems that are built with that kind of thing in mind. You know, with great power, even Dresden Files to a degree. But for the type of game we're playing right now, and actually for most of the games I've played, I don't think I would do that in combat, not because of me, but because of the way combat tends to be. It's not just you. At this point, the whole group is trying to succeed at something. I would have a problem just saying, I want to fail this in this manner, because to me, I'd be looking around the rest of the group. Have I just cost us this thing that we're trying to achieve? Yeah. By choosing the story moment that I think is really cool.
Actually,
did Pat get eaten by a dragon because I chose?
Because of your action.
Yeah.
And he's got a good point.
Outside of combat, I would do it without even.
You're playing D&D, you're the healer, and you say, you know what, I'm too panicked to heal.
Freaking awesome.
You're playing Skies of Glass. You don't shoot the bad guy, and because you didn't shoot him, he instead shoots somebody else's character, and Skies of Glass being Skies of Glass, the guy's just lost an arm now.
But how many times?
Because you did nothing. I mean, I realize it's realistic.
Oh, yeah. No, and it's
but
cool.
How well is that going to go over at the metagame level?
I actually have 2 points on that. Okay. One point is pretty easy, is that if you're the game master and somebody does this, don't use that against them.
Yes.
You know, somebody on the forum said that the dungeon master for narrative combat has to be on the player's team. I disagree with that. The game master shouldn't be on the player's team. The player shouldn't be on the game master team. Everybody's on the same team. There's only one team, and everybody's on it. And
I think you're agreeing with him.
I'm totally agreeing with him. I'm more vehemently agreeing with him. Is what I'm doing.
You're agreeing with him in a contrary fashion.
Yeah. So
it's Chad. I mean,
the game master should not use that against a person if somebody chooses to fail like that. In fact, you should reward them somehow, which is actually one of our topics we're going to hit. But you should reward them or reward the team. If so-and-so says, oh, I'm too panicked to heal, I just shake in fear. Great scene. Don't kill another person because of that. Let that scene happen, but kind of
I think game masters, and I'll blame myself for this. This is not something I've done in recent years, but particularly my early days as a game master, was something that I was guilty of all the time. The players had to play at a certain level because I was playing at a certain level. Mm-hmm. Because I, as a game master, was not going to pull my punches. The enemies never make mistakes.
Right.
And so as a result, if it's a balanced combat, the party can't afford to make any mistakes.
And see,
you're not allowed to be anything but perfect.
See, and that's just it, is that I think it gets back to trust and playing in character.
Right.
Both sides need to trust each other, and both sides need to play in character. When you make a bad guy or when you make a monster, the monster has faults. That doesn't mean panic buttons. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about faults. Like an example, in the last show, we talked about the bad guy that jumped on Pat and grabbed him by the hair and reared up the knife and was going to take his frigging head off. And then they did something to throw that off, and she sliced and then popped her shoulder out of the socket and spun around.
Yeah.
And I think that instead of players beating, just shin kicking a monster to death, why not have the monster make mistakes that the players exploit? wouldn't that be a cool victory? Don't have to do it every time.
Well, it's a great victory. Are you kidding? I mean, that if especially if they're into it and they see that happen, they're not players won't look at it as, oh, he's given us a chance. You know, they're looking at it as like, that monster just f***ed up, let's get him. You know?
Yeah.
They see it for the mistake that it was, that you intended it to be, not any sort of, you know, quote-unquote break or easiness that you're making it for them. And then they jump on it. And that is a sign of a move well done on your part as a GM.
Yeah. And I think that you'd have to be careful to balance that. I think there's a fine line between throwing them a give, which is cheap, and
well, it's playing the bad guys in character.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, the bad guys do not have the GM's omniscience.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple. Bad guys are going to make mistakes just like players are going to make mistakes. And if you want your players to get to a point where they are so in character that they are willing to admit, yeah, my guy's not ballsy enough to charge the dragon, then you've got to hit a point where the dragon may underestimate the fact that the guy in the plain clothes is actually the wizard.
Yeah,
I don't know what. I mean, I'm just making random stuff up, but you get my point. Whatever you want out of a game, don't expect something that you yourself won't put into it. And you know what? I'd say the same thing to a player. Don't ask your GM to play the bad guys more believably if you yourself will not play more believably. Mm-hmm. And if what you want out of a game is you want a min-max tactical game because to you, that's what's interesting is trying to figure out how to make the rules bend a certain way to achieve things you shouldn't be able to achieve and whatever, obviously this advice is not for you. But for somebody out there who is interested in that, I mean, this is, I think, something to ponder.
And getting, and I actually had a second point that I forgot and that I actually remember now. Getting back to the, would you, you know, roll a success and willingly fail so that you can narrate out a cooler scene? And, you know, people may not want to do that. And I don't know. Because of Wayne's point of, if I fail, that screws the other guys in the party, and that's not fair to them. Well, have you ever been in a combat or a situation, a role-playing game, where there are some guards, and they're guarding a doorway, and you know, maybe we can sneak on them like this. Well, maybe we can con them like this. Well, maybe we could use mind control social skills to work on them like that. And one guy says, screw it, enough of this plan, and I run around the corner, guns blazing. It's the same thing. He is endangering the rest of the group by
play
playing
games with you, Chad.
Yeah, exactly. he is endangering the group by playing in character
and making
cool scenes.
I suppose.
But that's before the dice start.
Well,
so everyone says that's acceptable.
And that's not per se. I think the nuance that I would draw is a little bit different is you're not per se saying, I want to fail. I think a closer example would be to say, like, I run up at the guy's guns blazing and fall on my ass before I get a shot off. And so you've alerted them and accomplished nothing. I mean, not even I think would be a closer analogy.
But even in Chad's analogy or attempted analogy, what you're describing is that someone who is playing their character. I mean, I've done that situation too, where we sat with a group and they planned and they planned and they planned. And my character was not a planner. My character was someone who mindlessly charged into combat situations like that. And they kept planning and planning. And finally, I just said, screw it. And my character charged in there and I made everybody at the table really angry. And my character paid for it big time. But
as they should.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah, she totally did. But for me, I felt great about the whole situation because I was being more true to the character. So
my current character is designed with that in mind. Mm-hmm. If the planning goes on too long, he'll jump in the middle of something like a lake.
What? Wait a minute. I call shenanigans. You were sitting there trying to talk with that bitch for hours on end. After she says, I'm here to kill all of you, I jump down after her and you try to stop me.
I didn't try to stop you. I let you jump down.
Yeah, you intend. Yeah, uh-huh.
The character has been more willing to talk lately. He's grown.
Yeah. So don't give me this jump in the middle of the lake thing when I was the one that jumped in the middle of the lake. And then you stopped me from jumping in the middle of the lake.
I wonder why I can't get anything accomplished in that campaign.
Yeah, I know. Because they won't let your Noel off the leash.
Yeah.
I love evil characters.
All right. We had a topic we were going to talk about today as our second topic, but I think it's going to go a little bit too long for this episode. So instead, I'm going to switch topics to the one we had planned for the next show.
Oh, snap.
Oh, whoa. Whiplash.
And I am going to tell you right from the start that I'm going to have to pass this topic largely to Wayne and Chris because they have experience in this and I do not. In fact, I'm glad at least two hosts did because if we didn't have two hosts with experience, I'd probably have to put this off for a roundtable table outside.
Oh, time to hit Facebook. Folks.
Well, no, no, Chad, don't check out because of the fact that while I
No, mean, I'm checking out. Too late.
Has a lack of experience ever stopped you from having opinions?
Oh, God, no.
Organized play sucks. Boom. Facebook.
All right, we're going to make you defend that point, but that's what we're going to talk about is organized play. Let me go ahead and set this up, and then I want to pass off to Chris and Wayne. For anyone who's really new to the hobby, the gist of organized play is that there are a couple groups out there, the Living Thing through D&D and the Pathfinder Society being two of the largest ones, but there's several groups like this where you have a certain set of pre-approved characters. You go in, the events are moderated, you play through adventures, they track your progression, and you can take this character from event to event with strangers or with people you know, and you keep progressing through in a story that is unfolding in one manner or another with one level of depth or another over a large number of people. This is not your gaming group. This is something where you could go to any convention, bring your approved player, and get into an adventure. Now, the definition set for anyone who is not previously familiar, Chris, would you go ahead and give us a starting place for the conversation? Give us one thesis to begin with.
Well, actually, you pretty much took everything I was just going to say. No, about...
if it was going to take you 20 minutes to say that,
and
no,
show.
That is actually... my level of experience came in with Living Greyhawk, and so that's kind of where I'll be drawing from as I make my various points and whatnot. And this was through the RPGA, which was run through TSR long ago, and then Wizards, of course, you know, after that came through. So any of the stuff that came before 3rd edition, I really didn't have any experience with that. There was a Living City, and they had a bunch of other stuff. But Living Greyhawk back in 2000, 2001 is where I kind of really cut my teeth on that organized play. And your definition is actually spot on. That is really what it is. There is very much good and there's very much bad with that type of setup. And I guess it all depends on really, within it, like with anything, what you want to get out of it. If you enjoy being able to play a character and take them around to various small conventions or even go to the larger ones at Gen Con and play in these events where you know certain items can be found or you can participate in this certain overarching story, whether it's a conclusion or whether it's a, you know, a Gen Con only type thing, that's great. You can really enjoy that. There's a lot of benefit to it. There's a lot of nice socializing. You get to meet a lot of nice, interesting people. There's a lot of crunch because when you first start, there's a lot of addictive little properties that come up in the game. The best way to equate it would be to being achievements.
Give me an example.
Well, a good example is when you go through any adventure, you end up getting a set amount of experience points and whatnot. But the items, the special items that you get, say if you were to get a wand of magic missile, you actually are going to get a certificate that says this is a wand of magic missile and it has this many charges on it. And while that's relatively mundane, that's just kind of a base example. There are many certs, as they're called, that are more rare and difficult to find with certain adventures and in certain regions. So things vary from region to region that you're in. So like, for example, up in Minnesota, in the world of Greyhawk, our region was part of the Shieldlands, for anybody who's familiar with Greyhawk. But you get down to Missouri, where you were, and I believe that was the Verbabank region. And so the cool part about this is we could travel down to Missouri, which we did, actually, and go and play in a con there over a couple of days. And you just kind of Iron Man it through. You go several days going through this thing. You go through the events, you get your experience, you get your character up, you get your certs, and you build up this character. And then you can take it back to your home region, and you can whip out these extra really cool items and amaze and astound all the other players at your table, which is, you know, kind of a nice little social thing.
That's not something that every one of these has, though. Like with Pathfinder Society, there are these set encounters that you go through. You can get stuff from them, but it's not regional like you're describing for Living Greyhawk.
Am I the only one here who's thinking about counterfeiting magical item certificates?
Well, I actually had a different question here.
Yes, that came up, Chad.
Well, I was guessing it did.
It had to have.
Yeah, that was kind of a low-hanging fruit I wasn't going to go after. But you talked about how if you go through the adventure and were able to accomplish certain things or find certain things, you could win these certs. Obviously, these are large organizations. It's probably not real unlikely that information on these adventures would eventually find its way around, especially if you were a GM or something at one point, or had a friend who was. What keeps you from basically gaming it to say, well, I know where the magic sword is hidden, so when we enter the room, I'm the first one to open that drawer, so I get the cert. Are these items handed out randomly?
There's not necessarily that much to prevent you. I mean, if you have a circle of friends and you go to a con, or you would have gone to a con, and maybe that event was being run at a couple of different times, and so as a group, you break up. Somebody would go and play that event first, then another group would come and play it later on, maybe getting some tips as to, yeah, go and make sure you check out here because you can get this.
Well, we had that with True Dungeon.
Yeah, we did have that with True Dungeon.
Think of it like a video game, too. There will be people doing walkthroughs and things like that. You're just cheating yourself out of the experience.
Yeah, well, and so, I mean, there was never really that much motivation. And even a couple of my friends who were, like, hardcore. I mean, these guys, they were the Ron Jeremy and Peter North of Living Greyhawk. I swear to God. They went to cons like nobody's business. I mean, that was just loose leaf binder filled with they had just was amazing. I mean, you just were awestruck by the stuff that they got.
When you use the example, though, of a video game, I think the difference is if you use a video game walkthrough and get the best gun in the game, you've not stopped me from getting it, I think is the difference. There's no competitive element to you and I playing single player games separately. But when it's something where, as Chris is saying, that being able to bring these certs because of the fact that they are not shared, it's not like if somebody finds a magic wand, everybody gets the magic wand. That's where I would more kind of say, isn't there an issue with the system
getting
gained
on
here?
Actually, one problems I had with it. There is stuff to get. Everyone had their own mission within the encounter that they had to do to get their reward. And because of that, when you run into a situation, you know, like us, when we would run into a bad guy that Chad's thrown at us, we may be thinking about how can we talk our way around this? How can we do something original and different? If you do that in one of these encounters, you could be screwing someone else out of their special thing or their special reward.
So in a sense, you're saying that the structure of the event and the structure of the way that you're rewarded almost takes away some of the freedom?
Yes.
And see, to me, that really bothers me because that's why I play an RPG. I can't tell you how many times I'm playing a video game and a choice tree comes up and I'm like, damn it, I wish this was a tabletop RPG because I would do thing E that isn't even on this list of A through D. And I would...
I've got some positive and negative things to say about it, but that was the biggest drawback for me.
Is you kind of have to release yourself because of a social contract.
That is where some of the bad comes in, is in the way the events are structured. I ended up... I wrote at least one event with our Shieldlands region at some point in time. And there were very, very strict guidelines as to the number of encounters, the number of combat encounters, and what items and things you could place in there. They really had very tight controls in there. And so it was very difficult for someone who considers themselves primarily as a role player, someone who's there for the experience, to really enjoy and get into it because of some of those restrictions. Now, granted, not every GM that you sat down at a table with followed this. I mean, I sat down at one event where we basically were able to essentially beat the event in the very first encounter. And the GM was like, oh, wow, okay, you're doing that. All right, well, and he basically kind of took the adventure and threw it out. And he role-played around it, which was fine, but it was a very odd experience. But that is some of the negative with that. And of course, the certs and the items and the things themselves also are a bit of a negative because it's a lot of paperwork. It really is a lot of paperwork. I'm not kidding when I was saying that my friends had a loose leaf binder, you know, and you maybe would only have enough room in there for two or three characters because a good chunk of it is all of this character's stuff. Because with each event that you would play, you also got a little record sheet of that event that dictated how many experience points that you got and things that happened in there and certain rewards that your character may have earned, you know, non-item related rewards. So there was a lot of paperwork, but with the kind of structure that they had set up, you needed that.
I don't know in the case of like Living Greyhawk, but with Pathfinder Society, the GM, after he's done running the game, has to go onto the website and register you and what you did on there, as well as you go in and do it as well, to basically keep everyone honest.
Well, and that's the thing, is that because you do get a lot of people who try and, like you're saying, game the system, because they're gamers at heart, and if they see chance to do a tabletop version of a cheat code, they're going to take advantage of it. And so you have to have a tighter structure. And I can understand where a lot of these groups come from in trying to create a somewhat rigid structure. Because the enjoyment of being able to have a character that you can cart from table to table and sit down and play, there is an enjoyment factor to it. Yeah, there's a lot of story continuity and goofy things that really come up when you look at the maybe the path that this character has taken over its lifetime, which doesn't make some sense. But yet, at the same time, you are still enjoying what you're doing.
You can sit down at a table with anyone that's running this and be a part of the game. I mean, one of the things I really have to give for what I know of Pathfinder Society is the inclusiveness. They have written in their rules and their explanation very clearly a specific rule that is designed where if a session is supposed to have five people, but a sixth person comes in and wants to play, you let them sit and play. It's written right in the rules of the society that anyone that wants to play sits down, plays, takes a part in it, and that will override every other rule at the table, is that everyone gets to play, everyone gets to have fun. And it even does say in there, if your players do come up with some interesting way to get around the bad guy, find a way to give them the reward, but they could still end up missing an entire hallway because of it.
See, and I think that's where some of that has evolved, because what I'm talking about in reference to the Greyhawk is stuff, you know, that was about 10 years old, and the stuff that you're referencing is really maybe, what, 5 years old, if not younger? And there is some definite evolution where I think people who would have expressed some of the frustrations and things that I'm pointing out here adapted and found out ways to make it and expand on it a little bit better. One other thing in relation to Living Greyhawk that I think was one of its interesting and unique strengths, and this was part of the appeal, is when you would go to these mini cons, they would have what are called interactives, and these are con-only events. And they're about as close as Living Greyhawk got to LARPs, because you didn't really go and sit down at tables for the majority of the event. All of the characters and all of the players who were there kind of hung out in like a central room, and there would be kind of an event going on, and you'd be walking around and maybe talking to the characters or whatever. And then at certain times in the evening, events would come up and certain events would occur and happen. And then at that point in time, the GMs would grab groups of characters. Sometimes it was whoever you were standing with, or sometimes it was certain characters of various classes or whatever. And you would get pulled to have to go and accomplish these little mini missions inside of this entire interactive. And those
that sounds like a world event in an MMO.
Yeah, it was just a really interesting and kind of fun activity. And of course, the added appeal was that these were things that you could only experience at those cons, which enhanced the experience a little bit as a player and gave you a bigger sense of satisfaction and justified you traveling several hundred miles, you know, and paying hotel fees and all of that kind of stuff just to get some pieces of paper.
For some of the reservations that we've had, even as an outsider, I hear a couple things in this that I'm going to give as positives. The first off is obviously this would have an appeal to anyone who does not have a consistent gaming group.
Definitely. I mean, I think it'd be a great way for someone to start gaming just to learn the basics. But for me, there, they would want to move up into a regular group.
I guess, but man, if you're just one of those people where you just can't find a lot of people around you who want to game or whatever, this is better than not gaming at all.
Yeah, and from talking to a lot of these guys, sometimes they meet their groups doing these.
Yeah.
Like a regular group will form out of one of these and they'll go play other things as well.
The second thing is I could see an appeal to a certain type of person who really likes the sense of competition, the sense of achievement, or even maybe just the challenge of trying to work with what you have. Here's four strangers. We have to work together to accomplish something without any pre-planning, any pre-balancing, whatever. And I can see why that would appeal to someone's, going back yet again to Aaron Stack's petty little victories, you know. And the third thing that I see is the fact that this also encourages community. Since you're going out and intermingling amongst strangers and talking to other people and going to these conventions and meeting new people and blah, 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 and anyone you meet who's doing this, you instantly have something in common with. This creates a sense of community that breaks one of the problems that I think has plagued gaming for years, which is the fact that it's a cellular hobby. Your gaming group has fun by itself and very rarely interacts with other gamers, whereas in this sort of setup,
you go to a website and you find a game.
Your gaming group is the entire society. It is the entire subculture. It's not just the same four guys or the same five guys.
And that really, honestly, I would say of the three things that you point out, that one to me was the strongest one because, I mean, it was the variety of people that I got to meet, even if it was just for just that one time, was phenomenal. I mean, it just really, I was very, very pleased to see the number of people that would continually turn out for these events. And I did get to know some of them beyond just the convention, and they're great guys. They were great players, and it was nice to meet.
And one of the interesting things is, Chris is going to hit on this a little bit, it's built around the actual event itself. So, for example, you don't get XP for everything you kill. You get XP for attending the event. You don't get, bigger benefits for crushing the bad guys, everything going well, than you would for barely making it through. Your character may not have survived it, and you can still get the bonus for having been there.
So let me ask you guys this. What's the story, character, plot ratio to just we're going through a map and killing?
Honestly, it reminded me of how you described Left 4 Dead. It is a...
Chris's Left 4 Dead game?
No, the actual video game.
Oh, okay. Because I had some pretty choice words to say.
There is a lot of implied plot to what I played through. There are built-in factions, built-in worlds. The scenario you're in has its own implied plot, but I'm using the word implied.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, does this give you something more than an old... like dungeon run module?
Honestly, for Living Greyhawk, it depended on what region that you were in. Because the way they had the structure set up, and I'll using, again, the Shieldlands as an example, there were three individuals who essentially were in charge of that region throughout. And this was a multi-state region. And those three guys, one of whom I was friends with, they made a very concerted effort to make sure that for all the adventures that ran over the course of 1 year, because it was structured in a year-by-year basis, that there was an overarching plot for that entire year, and that every adventure that ran within there in some way tied into that uber plot. Yeah, you may have gone off on a little bit of a tangent with this adventure, or you may have gone on a different tangent with that adventure, but everything dealt with that central plot. And so by the end of the year, you did feel as if you had participated in some sort of bigger storyline. And then the next year played off of that first year, and they built upon that. Now, that was because they devoted a lot of time and attention to making sure that there was some enjoyable experience in regards to that. Other regions...
Pathfinder Society has seasons.
Yeah, in other regions I was into, the reports and things I heard, it wasn't really so much that. Yeah, they had a bunch of just kind of, they were just dungeon crawl set in this particular region, and nothing really tied them together. So I think a lot of it depended upon where you were and who was in charge.
In an individual game, if I were playing in it, would I be able to go into anywhere? A tavern or a temple or the capital, the king's chamber, whatever.
And
role play with them and talk and have a conversation, or would everybody be staring at me fuming that we're not getting to map and dice?
I would think that would depend on the scenario and the group you were sitting with.
Yeah, and I'm talking also go to the tavern beyond getting the clue or the quest to go to the dungeon to roll dice on the map. I mean, I'm talking like actual role-playing and story development.
Is your character getting in the way of their assert?
That's where a couple of the other bad things come in, is that for people who are role-players and who like to explore, again, even if you're not playing at a con, because the majority of these were played with home groups, either your individual gaming group or group people in the area, you sat down and you played this, and you had a little bit more flexibility with home groups, but in the con setting, you were stuck in that con setting for an event, so you had really only about a four-hour window to go and do that. And so, are you a little bit railroaded? Yep. Yeah, you are. And so that's...
Something hilarious. Chad and I were playing World of Warcraft one night. It was me and Chad. I can't remember who the third person was, but it's somebody from the Fear the Boot community. I can't remember who it was. And then we had a random pickup group guy. So it was four people in a five-man group. And we were at the end of Lower Blackrock Spire. And between the three booters, we had healer, tank, and DPS. And we decided on the final boss fight to rotate roles.
Yes.
Not rotate characters, rotate roles. Mm-hmm. So the DPS was tanking, the healer was DPSing, and the DPS was healing.
Tank was healing.
The tank was healing. He was bandage healing.
Yes.
And, of course, it went horribly wrong.
And we never told the fifth guy. By the end, we never let him in on it.
By the end,
he's like, "What the hell are you guys doing? Yeah. Oh my god, why is the DPS pulling up?
Rage quit!
And so the three of us, by the end of it, we were all in vent together. The three
of us were just rolling,
even though we just wiped. The three of us were just rolling, and yeah, the fourth guy rage quit
because you know he was there for we were wasting his time, and honestly. To be perfectly honest, we were. We wasted the guy's time. Sorry, dude.
Well, because he was in it for a particular thing. And I think, Chad, what you just described is the exact same thing, that people that go there are probably, not always, but probably going to have the attitude, they're in it for the certs, they're in it for the XP.
Yeah.
They're not.
They're in it for their fun, not your fun.
Right.
It was a min-maxer's dream for a lot of people. I mean, I'm not kidding. It was, there was this guy, and I wouldn't get into a gaming story, but his character... He did everything that he could to have it do as much damage as humanly possible. And it was just, I would just sit stunned on the other end of the table that, oh my gosh, did you really crunch the math to figure this out? Because he was doing ridiculous amounts of damage. And for him, it was great. For me, it was like, okay. You know, but like you said, you go there for a certain thing, that's what you get out of it. One last thing. The one really frustrating thing for me that came out of all this was that a character that I had in Living Greyhawk, and I ran her for a couple of years, honestly, my favorite character of all time. And the frustrating part for me was is that she was my favorite character in my mind only, because there was so much I wanted to do character development-wise with her, I was never able to really fully explore because of the restrictions that was on there. And I knew what I wanted her to do. I had this vision for her and was able to accomplish little bits of it, but it was never something that was fully realized, and that ended up being one of my favorite characters that I never really was able to fully play.
So real quickly, Wayne and Chris, do you guys have any advice for somebody who's heard this, thinks this sounds like something they'd want to do, and wants to get started? Do's and don'ts, places to look, things to avoid, things to be sure you do.
Pathfinder Society is free. Go to the website, find a group. Just try it. It hurts nothing. I had never played one before Fear the Con. I signed up for a game. I played. I had fun. I know in the long run it's not my thing, but I think it would be a good introduction for someone.
Okay, Chris?
It is very, it's very enjoyable. It's a good experience. Don't go in there thinking that you're going to have the role-playing experience of a lifetime, but it is fun, and enjoy it for the benefits that it does provide. The social aspect of it and the transportability aspect of it, you will come to really, I think, enjoy.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys both for your insight on this, and as for you, the listeners, thank you guys for tuning in. We hope that you continue to have great games, and we look forward to catching you all same time next week.
See ya.
Later, dude.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.